Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. Lung cancer is the second most common cancer in both men and women and is the leading cause of cancer death in the United States. Overall, the chance that a man will develop lung cancer in his lifetime is about 1 in 13, and for women, the risk is about 1 in 16. Cigarette smoking is by far the most well-known risk factor associated with lung cancer, but it frequently affects people who have never smoked. What are some of the other risk factors for this deadly disease? Who is at risk? Who should be screened for this type of cancer? And how should those at risk be screened? Joining me to discuss these and other questions are Anchorage oncologist Dr. Richard Chung and Marge Stone King from the American Lung Association. Marge Stone King is the executive director of American Lung Association in Alaska, where she has served for 12 years. Marge works heavily in policy advocacy for tobacco prevention, healthy air, and lung health issues at the state and local level. Dr. Richard Chung attended undergraduate school at Stanford University and medical school at the University of California, Los Angeles. In 1994, he completed his residency at Stanford in the field of radiation oncology. Dr. Chung relocated to Anchorage that same year and began his practice at the Anchorage Radiation Therapy Center. Since arriving, Dr. Chung has been a champion of bringing in the newest and most advanced radiation therapy technologies so that Alaskan patients and their families can receive cancer treatment close to home. In 2013, with the help of Dr. Steven Settle, Dr. Chung began the Alaska Gamma Knife Center at Anchorage Radiation Therapy Center, which brought in the Leskell Gamma Knife Perfection, the most accurate and advanced radiosurgery technology available. Thank you both for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I need to take a moment to remind listeners how we can be reached with your questions or comments. You can call us locally at our number 550-8433 or our toll-free number if you're outside of Anchorage at 1-888-353-5752. And you can always email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. If you've never emailed us before, you got to spell out line one. That's L-I-N-E-O-N-E. All right. First question, Dr. Chung, I have no idea what a Leskell Gamma Knife Perfection is, and it sounds fancy. Can you give us an idea what that device is?
Thank you. About 20 to 40% of all cancer patients develop brain metastases or spread of the cancer to the brain from other parts of the body. We're discussing lung cancer today, and this is certainly a disease that can spread to the brain. Gamma knife treatment is a form of stereotactic radiosurgery, which is a non-invasive outpatient treatment of brain conditions, both cancerous and non-cancerous. It is a procedure performed in conjunction with our neurosurgery colleagues. The indications include brain metastasis, blood vessel abnormalities called AVMs, or arteriovenous malformations, nerve problems such as trigeminal neuralgia, or primary brain tumors such as acoustic neuroma, meningioma, chordoma, pituitary adenomas, etc. The latest model in the Gamma Knife lineup is the Perfection. It uses 192 cobalt sources focused on a single point in space with submillimeter accuracy. It also uses a robotic table to position the patient automatically. Any combination of the 192 sources can be used to deliver a shot of radiation precisely. Combination of shots provide a good dose conformality, delivering dose to where you want it and minimally to the areas that you don't want it. There is minimum dose exposure to surrounding tissue, and the treatment is completed in one fraction. The treatment uses a lightweight head frame placed under local anesthesia using four pins. The head frame ensures that the patient is in the correct position for the very precise treatment. After the frame is placed, treatment planning, MRI, and CT scans are performed, and the treatment plan is calculated. No further imaging is needed during the treatment. Up to 192 beams are delivered at the same time from different angles, allowing fast treatment delivery and minimal dose to the surrounding healthy brain. And this allows a non-invasive outpatient treatment option for patients with brain conditions that would typically require surgery or whole brain radiation therapy.
So it's a real fancy, like, laser goes in directly and targets really specific areas.
That is correct. It's a machine that is designed to deliver radiation very precisely to the brain only. It is not used to treat any other parts of the body.
All right. So, okay. Let's start off, I guess, Marge, since November is Lung Cancer Awareness Month. Can you talk about what you at the American Lung Association are doing in Alaska to raise awareness about the disease and what you're doing on the prevention front? Because I think prevention is obviously the best remedy for lung cancer.
Sure. So what we're doing in November all across the country and here in Alaska in partnership with Anchorage and Valley Radiation Therapy is promoting the Lung Force Initiative, which you can find out more about at lungforce.org. And Lung Force is a campaign to raise awareness around lung cancer, the fact that it's the number one cancer killer of men and women, but with a specific focus on women because the women's lung cancer rates are rising tremendously while men's are not. So though men still have lung cancer at a higher rate than women do, the women's rate is rising and people aren't aware of that.
Now, what do they attribute that to?
Well, in all likelihood, it has to do with women taking up smoking later historically in our country.
Okay.
And so women, if you will, are catching up on the disease front at this point. That's all we know at this point. And then the other things we want to do in terms of raising awareness is that anyone can get lung cancer. Yes, smoking is the number one risk factor, but anyone with lungs can get lung cancer. There are other risk factors, and it shouldn't be, even if a person is a smoker, that shouldn't be the first question out of your mouth. There shouldn't be a stigma. Nobody deserves to have lung cancer.
Right.
And there's a lot of work yet to be done on lung cancer that has progressed where with other cancers. So that stigma, I think, has kept people from standing up as survivors. A, there are fewer survivors, but also standing up as advocates, it's kept people quieter, which has resulted in it being the least funded of the major cancers in terms of research.
The stigma of you kind of did this to yourself if
yes.
you're a smoker, and so yeah, people aren't real proud to say I smoked. But I read on WTFLungCancer.com, which is where's the funding, right? It's a sort of a play on words, that it says that 80% of new lung cancer cases are diagnosed in patients who have never smoked or former smokers who quit decades ago. So that's what you're speaking to.
Right. So the second leading risk factor for lung cancer is actually radon exposure. And radon exposure can happen to any of us in our homes. And the only way to prevent it is to get a test kit for your home, find out if there's radon coming up through the soil into your home, and then prevent it from coming into your home. It's a, silent, colorless, no smell gas that comes from decaying uranium. Can occur anywhere in the United States.
Huh. All right. We're going to get to some of the risk factors here in a minute. I want to talk a little bit more about prevention. I read somewhere today that 9 out of 10 smokers, adult smokers, started before the age of 18. So what's being done on the targeting teens, and because that's where most smoking starts?
Right. That's absolutely true. And then I think it's like 95% to 99%. Of smokers if you take the age up to 24. So it's all youth and young adult that start smoking, and that's not by accident. That's who the tobacco industry targets with marketing to recruit replacement smokers for those who die out later in life. We've made great progress here in Alaska and across the country, but here in Alaska we used to be one of the highest youth smoking rates, over 30%, and now we're down between 10 and 11% of youth smoking. We've done that through smoke-free public places, through tobacco taxes, through state prevention funding, including media campaigns, and really made a big impact. We now need to do the same thing with electronic cigarettes because what we're seeing now is that kids are using electronic cigarettes at twice the rate of traditional cigarettes and think that they don't have the same harms.
Okay. Yeah, I hear that a lot. I mean, as a therapist, I work with a lot of young teens, and the smoking is just not cool anymore. It's gone out of vogue, and smokers are, I mean, my kids now, when we drive down the road, they see somebody smoking, they're, you know, 9, 7, and 5, they're like, smoker, and they like yell and point, and
yep.
You know, so it's really ingrained into our youth. And I read, to speak to your numbers, that 9 out of 10 teens are not smoking.
Yeah.
But I do see a lot of them run around with those lanyards with the vaping sticks and e-cigarettes. Can you talk about is a lot of people think that's a safe alternative?
Well, the electronic cigarettes and are marketed by the tobacco industry, and they are not considered. Well, they're marketed as safer than cigarettes, but in fact, these are not just harmless water vapors included in the cigarettes. They contain different amounts of toxins that, since this is not an FDA-regulated product, they do not have to disclose what is in it, but testing have shown that they contain, other than nicotine, traces of heavy metals and other carcinogens. Like polyethylene glycol. So they're not considered safe. And they do also deliver nicotine, which is an addictive drug, and they get people hooked on it. So it's really not considered something that we should let our youngsters try.
Mm-hmm.
And it is alarming that between 2011 and 2012, the number of young kids, high school students that use electronic cigarettes doubled.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's a new thing on the market. It's been sort of, I know when it came out, everybody was, I'm going to quit smoking by using these. And a lot of teenagers have flocked to that. And I see it a lot, and it scares me. It worries me.
And you know, that might be an argument on the adult side, although it's not intended as a cessation device. And there
right.
are, you know, in fact, 7 FDA-approved nicotine replacement cessation drugs. E-cigarettes is not one of them. The industry did not go down that path. They're selling it as a tobacco product. But with kids, we're seeing the opposite trend, right? We're seeing kids who otherwise may have not been at risk for smoking start with e-cigarettes and become e-cigarette users. And even with adults who think that they are using them to quit, in most cases, they are using both, and so in fact, they're not reducing their nicotine.
We know that nicotine is one of the most addictive substances around, and the growing brain is particularly susceptible to the addictive properties of all chemicals. So I love the way you said they're targeting replacement smokers for those that are dying off, the cigarette companies. That's quite a model.
Yeah.
All right, so e-cigarettes not okay if you're a parent out there, or if you're an adult who's considering switching to that, there's alternatives. I did a show last July called Overcoming Nicotine Addiction with Dr. Ron Olson, psychologist in town, and I would refer people back to that for a more in-depth look at how to kick this nicotine habit, which is really, it's a bear.
Yeah. And 1-800-QUIT-NOW, of course, is the state quit line that's free, and you can get your free nicotine replacement therapy through that.
Now, what's if you call 1-800-QUIT-NOW, what are you going to be hooked up with? What kind of supports?
So free telephone counseling and nicotine replacement therapy. And so no cost. And that's the most effective combination is some kind of counseling support and a pharmaceutical.
So they'll help you come up with sort of a quit plan?
Yes.
And it is 24/7.
You can call anytime.
Right.
All right. Let's get a little bit into, I guess first I want to remind my listeners who might be tuning in late that my guests today are Anchorage oncologist Dr. Richard Chung and the executive director for the American Lung Association in Alaska, Marge Stone King. And we are discussing lung cancer screening and prevention, and I guess we'll get a little bit into treatment here towards the end of the show. You can reach us with your questions or comments at our local phone number, 550-8433, or call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So, Dr. Chung, what is lung cancer?
Lung cancer is the uncontrolled growth of abnormal cells that start in one or both lungs. Yeah, your lungs, everybody knows that it is used for gas exchange, and the trachea branches into the right mainstem bronchus and the left mainstem bronchus, and in turn it branches into smaller bronchioles, and at the end there are little very thin-walled sacs called alveoli, which where the gas exchange happens. Any of these cells can mutate and turn bad and become a cancer which grows uncontrollably. And there are basically two main types of lung cancer depending on the cells where they originate from. And one is called small cell lung cancer. This makes up about 10 to 15% of all lung cancers. Under the microscope, these cells look quite small. But they have a very aggressive behavior. They tend to spread early and spread to multiple areas. For that reason, small cell lung cancers are typically not treated by surgery and is treated by chemotherapy with radiation therapy if appropriate. The other type, the more common type of lung cancer, is called non-small cell lung cancer, and it is made up of three different types of cancers, but they're grouped together because they're treated similarly. The first is squamous cell cancer. Squamous means flat. It is made up of flat cells that line the airways. So squamous cell carcinomas is made up of about 25 or 30% of all lung cancers. The most common type is called the adenocarcinoma, which is originates from cells that produces mucus. And they represent about 40% of all non-small cell lung cancers. And then the last type is the large cell carcinoma.
Are they, is one more aggressive than the other? I think you mentioned small cell is more aggressive.
That's right. Typically, small cell is the most aggressive.
Okay. Thinking about treatment, is there a different approach to each type?
For the small cell lung cancers, definitely the treatment of choice is chemotherapy with or without radiation. Surgery does not play a role in small cell lung cancers. Whereas the other types, the non-small cell lung cancers, if the cancer is detected very early, meaning it is just localized in the lungs and hasn't spread to the lymph glands or elsewhere distantly, when it has spread to the lymph glands, we call it regional disease. When it has spread distantly, we call it metastatic disease. If it's only localized in the lungs, it can be treated very effectively by surgery. Even if it has gone to some of the lymph nodes, it can still be treat it surgically if it hasn't gone to too many lymph nodes. And if it has gone to too many lymph nodes, then it can be treated with chemotherapy with or without radiation therapy.
Okay. Is lung cancer, difficult to detect? What are some of the early signs that people should be looking for if, they're concerned? How do you know if you got it?
Well, I'll start with that one and let Dr. Chung go from there. One of the reasons that it is the number one cancer killer is that people don't tend to know they have it until the disease is further advanced because you don't have nerve endings in your lungs.
Can't feel it.
So once you have symptoms, exactly. Once you have symptoms, then your disease is quite progressed. And because up until very recently, there hasn't been a screening modality that people could use to be able to detect it, like mammograms or colonoscopies.
So up until recently, essentially, you're just waiting. I mean, people go along in their lives and they're smoking or not smoking, being exposed to radon, and they start coughing, blood or mucus, or what are the things that most likely indicate lung cancer?
Right. They can have shortness of breath. They can be coughing up blood. They can lose weight unexpectedly. If it has spread to other parts of the body, they can develop pain if it went to the bones. They can have blood vessel blockage, causing what we call superior vena cava syndrome, where the blood can't return to the heart efficiently. They can develop seizures if the cancer went to the brain. So there can be many, many different symptoms, but typically it means that the cancer is pretty far gone.
Getting back to a question I forgot to ask, and I wanted to ask about young people before we get into the screening stuff, is I read that in doing research that lungs are impacted by smoking during development. That can have impacts well into adulthood, even if you quit smoking. What is the impact of smoking on the developing lungs?
Well, we certainly have a lot of evidence about adverse effects from smoke exposure, any kind of smoke exposure, in children, in infants, and even in utero, right? Exposure to nicotine, as you mentioned earlier about nicotine effect on the brain, but then the smoke effect on the lungs. air pollution, any kind of smoke is bad for all of us. But the people that are the most vulnerable are our children, because their lungs are still developing, and because pound for pound in their body weight, they breathe in twice as much air as an adult does. So their respiratory rate's faster, breathing in more air, so they're getting more of it, and their lungs are developing and can be affected by the smoke as those are growing. Then on the other end of the spectrum, the elderly or folks with lung disease who are already compromised in some way are going to be more vulnerable to smoke, including secondhand smoke and any kind of outdoor air pollution or indoor air pollution.
That's been a big wave in the last 10 years of secondhand smoke and avoiding breathing in other people's. I mean, parents are encouraged, if they have to smoke outside. Restaurants have gone away from it. But also on clothing, I've heard the secondhand smoke, the smoke that is caught in clothing. What are the impacts and the consequences for secondhand smoke, especially to children?
Well, many of the same effects as smoking. Secondhand smoke has many of the same effects. So a bystander is going to have a very similar level of nicotine,
right,
as a primary smoker, as well as the ultrafine particles and carcinogens in the cigarette smoke doesn't get diminished by going through someone's lungs. So the bystanders are getting the same effects, and that impacts both your cardiovascular health as well as your lung health, lung tissues, and potential development of lung cancer.
Right. In my reading, the secondhand smoke increases the risk of the person exposed to secondhand smoke by about 1.25%, or what we call relative risk. So the relative risk is 1.25% compared to somebody who's not exposed to secondhand smoke.
And the particles are so small in smoke, and likewise in secondhand aerosol of an e-cigarette, particles are so small that they, actually can cross into the bloodstream within the lungs, and therefore present a cardiovascular risk as well as lung.
Because there's other risks associated with smoking besides lung cancer, correct?
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
Obviously.
Cardiovascular is a more immediate effect, as well as, a more prevalent long-term chronic effect. But those ultrafine particles is also the beginnings of lung cancer, can be the beginnings of lung cancer as well, because they go so deep into the lungs, they can get lodged there and begin that growth of abnormal smoke.
So I was talking upstairs to somebody before the show, and she asked, will you ask our guests why anybody starts smoking?
Oh, that's a great question.
I mean, with all the information that's out there and the media blitz of and the campaigns that you guys at the American Lung Association are putting out, why do people start? What's your research say about that?
Well, just exactly what we discussed earlier, the answer lies in understanding that adults don't start smoking. Children do. And children are so strongly influenced by the media and have less of a sense of reality and media And being able to differentiate between those. You ask a room full of teens what percentage of the adult population they think smokes, and you get answers anywhere from 75% to 99%.
Really?
It's less than 20%. But what you see in the movies,
right?
What you see in the magazines, so that comes across as reality to kids. So, as we discussed, we've made a lots of progress in terms of changing those perceptions on kids. But the tobacco industry is always there, and new products all the time, new products that don't fall under the same legislation, that don't get the same kind of prevention messages out. We just have, they have billions and billions of dollars. They spend $1 million an hour marketing.
$1 million an hour.
Yep. In the U.S.
Mm-hmm. That's remarkable. Can you talk about the importance of modeling? You just spoke about movies and images and the impact on children of their parents. I mean, most of the kids who smoke, I ask them pretty routinely, where did you get your first cigarettes? And it's usually from mom or dad, from their purse, or they grew up watching their parents smoke.
Yeah, that's definitely true statistically, that parents smoking is a risk factor for kids taking up smoking. It's also the same reason that we do things like tobacco-free campuses on schools and UAA, that later this week, and University of Alaska system, tobacco-free campuses. It's not just about secondhand smoke. It's about removing the influence because of the modeling, yes. So if kids see people using tobacco or smoking in public places, in the workplaces, at school, whatnot, there's a perception that it's safe, that it's okay, right?
I often tell parents the best thing you can do to get your kid to stop smoking is to stop yourself, to set
Absolutely.
That example.
Absolutely.
And Alaska Regional Hospital and Providence have all gone smoke-free campuses.
Yes.
Is my understanding.
Right.
Yes, yes.
That happened a while ago, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, about 10 years ago, I'd say.
Many years ago.
Yeah.
All right, so we need to get into some of the screening questions. I'm wondering, so if somebody is getting, they're concerned about their risk, they're concerned about their exposure to cigarettes, or what is this, the new screening? You mentioned before, recently, there wasn't screening in place. So what's happening on that front?
Right. In the past, researchers have tried to use chest x-rays as a screening tool, but they found that it wasn't really effective. They did chest x-rays on smokers, but it was not sensitive enough to catch the early stage lung cancers to make a difference. Then they decided to say, oh, what about adding sputum? Let's ask them to submit a sputum sample. Maybe we can find some cancer cells in the sputum, and in conjunction with chest x-ray, maybe that would work. But it really didn't work. So those were not approved as screening tools. So recently, within the last 10 years or so, people started using the CAT scanner, or the computer axial tomography, to look at the lungs. Specifically, they're using a very low radiation dose type of a setting. It's called low-dose CT. Not given with any contrast in the veins to visualize the lungs. The image quality is not as good as the regular diagnostic CTs because the dose is so low. But on the other hand, the dose of radiation is much lower, so it is considered safer for the patients who are being screened. And studies have been done, and recently there was a big study that was called the National Lung Screening Study, and it was performed between 2002 and 2004, and they enrolled 53,000 patients and randomized them into two different treatment screening options. One is the low-dose CT every year, and the other one is to use a chest x-ray, just one posterior chest x-ray. And then they followed these patients for many years and found that the low-dose CT option was able to detect more cancers and prevent patients from dying from lung cancer more effectively compared with the chest X-ray option.
Okay, when we're at the halfway point of our show, so we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll get back to more of the screening. So I want to remind listeners that you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. My guests today are Anchorage oncologist Dr. Richard Chung and American Lung Association Alaska Chapter Executive Director Marge Stoneking. Our topic today is lung cancer screening and prevention. I want to remind people, if you have any questions or comments on our topic, you can reach us at 550-8433 or call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can also email your questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Chung and Marge Stoneking. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning in, my guests today are Anchorage oncologist Dr. Richard Chung and American Lung Association and Alaska Executive Director Marge Stoneking. Today we are discussing lung cancer, both the screening and prevention aspect, as well as some treatment options a little bit later. As always, you can email your questions or comments about today's show to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433 or reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, the show repeats tonight at 8 p.m., so if you're listening to this on Monday night, you'll be hearing a tape recording, and we will not be accepting phone calls. All right, so one thing I forgot to ask about, and this is now that marijuana has been legalized in this state and many others, it's starting to sweep across the country, I think. The question is marijuana smoke? I understand that all particulate matter is not good for the lungs. I mean, anything from dust to fire, campfire smoke, all this stuff is pretty bad for the lungs. But marijuana, is there any evidence that that is leading to lung cancer or emphysema or respiratory problems?
So marijuana smoke and secondhand smoke contains many of the same toxins and carcinogens found in tobacco smoke. The differences are, one, that people use marijuana differently. You don't smoke 20 marijuana cigarettes in a day like you do with tobacco.
I hope not.
Right. And until very recently, it's been an illegal product. So there is a lot less... There's been a lot less research done in terms of particularly long-term health effects. So we don't have conclusive answers, but there has been some evidence, yes.
Right. I was able to find two studies, one from Sweden, looking at this, and they found a twofold increase in development of lung cancer in people who use marijuana. And another study was from New Zealand, where they found a relative risk of 5.7, meaning 5.7 times you are as likely of developing lung cancer if you smoked marijuana compared to somebody who did not smoke marijuana.
All right, so the research is new. It's early in that process, but early evidence would suggest anytime you burn something and inhale it,
exactly,
it's probably not good for you.
Exactly.
All right, looks like we're getting some calls here, so we'll get into the screening questions. I really do want to get to that since that's important, but let's go ahead and go to Don. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, good evening or afternoon. Glad to hear from you again. To supplement what you just stated on those tests, carcinogens, et cetera, I seem to recall about 10 or 15 years ago, there was some data out that said something like 16 times more tar in marijuana smoke than in conventional tobacco. And also something about barbecuing steaks had as much, one barbecued steak had as much carcinogens as a carton of cigarettes.
Right, so marijuana, smokers tend to inhale more deeply and hold their breath longer than cigarette smokers, which does lead to a greater exposure per breath to tar, as you indicated.
Yeah, I know. I was one of them for four decades.
Ah.
That's the main reason I called is when I heard you give those statistics just a couple minutes ago before you took the break. Please repeat that again, those tests. And I'm hoping the VA will cover some of it because I'm a vet. And I quit about 21 years ago and it killed me. And they had defit. I was out in Palmer at the time. They had defit me three times before they got me into Providence and Anchorage. And I went cold turkey, man. That was, I packed up everything I had related to smoking and it was gone. That was, Doc told me what did me in was the one cigarette I was smoking right after breakfast while I was watching the news. And I was down for like 20, 25 minutes before anybody even got to me. So, I was pretty darn close.
Well, I'm glad you kicked it, and I'm glad you're still with us.
Congratulations.
Well, so am I. I mean, I'm over 70 now, but it's I'd like to hear those stats again, though, on the type of testing and the frequency of it, and basically what we can expect for an outcome as far as the accuracy of them is concerned.
We'll in terms of the screening, yeah, we'll get to that in just a minute. Thank you for calling.
I'm going to leave you then. I'll get off here and stop bending your ear. Thanks again.
Thanks for the call, Don. That's great. Let's go ahead and go to Sarah. How long is treatment is your question. You're on the air. Oh, she's gone. Okay. We missed her. Let's get back real quick. I got an email, a question about radon. Is the problem with radon dose and time dependent? How long would it take to develop cancer and would the screening be the same? I'm not sure what that is.
Yes, so the screening would be the same. Okay. The lung cancer would ultimately be the same.
I got you.
Different risk factor. There are tests for both short-term exposure and long-term exposure with regard to radon. Obviously, anything longer-term is going to be worse in terms of a bigger risk, right? The longer you smoke, the longer you're exposed to anything, the more risk you have. But you can get test kits in for both short and long-term. And you can find out more about that at www.lung.org and search radon, or you can always call our lung helpline at 1-800-LUNG-USA and find out where you can get one of those near you.
Okay. Let's get into screening. We got a lot of ground to cover on the screening subject. So let's start talking about screening. Who should be screened? What are the criteria? Where can they get it done? We'll get to each of those. But let's start with who should be worried and who should get screened.
Well, screenings in general, right, have made huge progress in terms of breast cancer, prostate cancer, colorectal cancer. And as I said earlier, we have not had that for lung cancer. So the recommendations are for a very specific population. And we really need more research to make that broader based. This recommendation and implementation of this screening will save lives. But we need to continue to find better early detection to improve lung cancer survivability. So right now,
right. I like to add to that the The screening study that I alluded to, the NLST study, identified the high-risk patients and defined them as adults who are aged between 55 and 74, who have had a 30-pack-year history of smoking, meaning the equivalent of a pack a day for a total of 30 years. And those patients who are continuing to smoke or have quit within the last 15 years. And these patients should also be healthy enough that they can undergo definitive treatment if cancer is found. So that's the NLST screening criteria. Then the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force used this data and did some additional modeling and issued their recommendation. So they expanded the age range from 55 to 80 years old, 55 to 80 years old. And then also, instead of just screening for three consecutive years, they said just go ahead and screen indefinitely until the patient is not healthy enough to continue to do the screening. So that's the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force recommendations.
So the screening is fairly limited. I mean, it's right now this is targeted at a certain population, and if you're outside of that population, if you're a lighter smoker,
then your insurance is not likely to cover it.
Okay.
So anyone could.
Anybody could do it, but there's a cost.
Exactly, and there are risks and benefits, right? This is the population that this is prescribed for, that this is most recommended for, and so therefore that's who Medicare covers for, Medicaid, and private insurers are starting to follow suit.
So if you fall in that category and you want to get this screening, what are the risks and benefits? You just mentioned that. There's obviously, I would imagine, the risk of early detection, but the benefit of that. But what are the risks and benefits of undergoing this treatment or this screening?
Yeah, the benefit is catching the non-small cell lung cancers at an early stage so that we have much more effective treatments, such as surgery to remove the part of the lung, or to do radiation if the patient is not healthy enough. There's a new way of delivering radiation for very early stage non-small cell lung cancers called stereotactic body radiotherapy, or stereotactic ablative therapy, SBRT or SABR, depending on who you read, that delivers a very, very high dose of radiation, and it has an excellent local control probability, and very similar to the cure rate of lung surgeries. So the benefit is to catch it early so you can treat it effectively and have a good, a much better survival probability. The drawback of doing screening is that sometimes you have false positives, meaning there's nothing there, but you see something there that's really not cancer. So that can lead to additional diagnostic tests or unnecessary biopsies, sticking needles in the lungs or doing bronchoscopies, which have inherent risks associated with it. So you can be harmed by it, or you can receive treatment that was really not necessary. Furthermore, there's a psychological risk for thinking that you may have cancer when you really didn't.
What is the frequency of false positives? I mean, they see a little spot or a mark on the imaging.
That's my understanding that the low dose CT scanning for lung cancer screening has a very similar rate of accuracy that mammograms do.
Yeah.
So mammograms, of course, are recommended for all women,
right,
in a certain age population, and not narrowed by risk factor. Well, to some extent, they are. If you have a genetic,
right,
predisposition, then you're encouraged to get it. But that's always something when they look at screenings, is false positives. It's always being analyzed.
Okay, let's go to the phones again. We have Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I was wondering, do you have any, or are you aware of any research, or do you have any information about individuals who use inhalers? I mean, operating under the theory of any exposure to particulates of any kind or foreign might have some negative effect. Have we got any information about using rescue inhalers or, you know, medicines like that? I'll take my answer. Yeah, thanks.
All right, thanks a lot. So albuterol or Advair, those kind of things?
No, so, right, it's a similar mechanism. I see where you're going with the vaporizer or vaping an e-cigarette. You're aerosolizing a liquid. You know, the difference is that it's a therapeutic liquid, not a toxic liquid.
Okay, so no.
So
it
no.
Sounds like it, people can rest easy with that one. So you're a person who fits in this category, and you, what's the steps people would take to go through to get this process started, to get into the screening?
Right. typically, patients will need to have their primary care provider to fill out an order form. The reason why this is not something that the radiology clinics want to have somebody just coming off the street to order that themselves is because there are going to be quite a few cases where they find something on the screening CT, and that needs follow-up. Someone needs to take charge of that and decide when to order the next imaging study, whether it's a diagnostic imaging or whether this is it's going to be a repeat of the non-contrast low-dose screening CT, maybe in 3 months, maybe in 6 months, maybe in another year. So someone needs to follow these patients. So therefore, the primary care provider is usually tasked with this responsibility.
All right, so they can't just come into your office, Dr. Chung, and say, I'd like to be screened. They go to their family physician, get a referral form if their physician sees that they meet these criteria, and then they'll send them to you?
Typically. Or if it's one of my patients who really want to have the screen, I can fill out this form as well. But they need a physician.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. So if you want to find out who offers it in Alaska, you can call our Lung Association Lung Helpline at 1-800-LUNG-USA. But it's going to start with a conversation with your primary care doctor at your annual physical, or if you're coming in with symptoms of some kind, or, you know, any visit. You know, our recommendation and the general practice these days is that at any visit, you're asked if you are a smoker,
right,
and counseled to quit. And so that conversation, this could be part of that conversation, or an annual preventive physical conversation.
All right. If you're joining us late, my guests today are Anchorage oncologist Dr. Richard Chung and American Lung Association Alaska Chapter Executive Director Marge Stone King. Our topic is lung cancer screening and prevention. You can call us with your questions at 550-8433 or call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to participate is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, so screening, where is the screening done? I know, Marge, you mentioned, is that the best way to find out where it's done is to go on to the number that you had or call the number you had mentioned?
That way, you're gonna find out what your options are.
Right. Most of the radiology clinics and hospitals in the Anchorage area have already started to do this, and the ones that haven't are gearing up to do this. One of the problems in the last couple of years is that. Since this is a very new test, the insurance companies, including Medicare, were not paying for this. So this was out of pocket.
And that's been changed.
That has been changed. Since February of this year, Medicare issued a memo indicating that they are going to be paying for this type of screening for patients who meet their criteria. Medicare criteria is slightly different than the one that I discussed previously. They go to age 77, 55 to 77, who are current smokers or have quit smoking within the last 15 years, and they have at least 30-pack year history of smoking.
and they need an order from a physician or a qualified non-physician practitioner, such as a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant. And then they need to have this at a designated, approved radiology center. And the radiology center has to also provide documentation of the patient that's being screened and then submit that to the Medicare Central database. So there are a few more hoops to jump through for Medicare patients.
But it is now being covered. That's good.
It is.
So Joe Blow, who comes in off the street and thinks he might have an exposure or risk for lung cancer, wants to pay for it out of pocket. How much does this type of screening cost? Is there a cost estimate for that if somebody wants to do it on their own?
It depends on the facility, of course, but I have heard between $100 and $200, so it's not.
Oh, so it's quite affordable.
Yeah,
I've heard $200 to $500.
Okay,
but I don't know that for a fact.
Yeah.
All right, so it's not something I was imagining
$10,000
or something that would just be out of the realm of possibility. So if you are considering it, what are the you said early detection, like is there a statistic or what's the advantage if you get it caught early versus late? I guess it's pretty terminal.
Right.
If you get it caught early, what are the survivability rates?
Right. And the difference is huge. For all lung cancers, all stages of lung cancer, this is a very difficult disease to treat. For all stages, the five-year probability of living is 17%, very low. But if you catch it early in the localized stage and you treat it, the five-year probability of survival is 54%. So you go from And if you catch it very late, if it has spread already, the five-year probability of survival is 4%.
Wow.
So therefore, it really pays to try to catch this disease early so that you can be in that 54% data rather than the 4% group.
Mm-hmm. And once it metastasizes and spreads to the other part of the body, it's really too late.
That's right. There's no cure for it.
On average, fewer than half of folks diagnosed with lung cancer today will be alive a year from today at current.
Right.
I read somewhere that in 1971 it was a 7% survivability for lung cancer, and now it's at 15%. But now, Dr. Chung, you're saying with this screening, it really bumps it up considerably.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes, because you're catching it earlier.
But the reality is that most patients with lung cancer, they're caught at a distant stage. 57% of the cancers are detected when they're distant. Only 16% of the cancers are caught when they're localized. So what we're trying to do, what this study and American Lung Association is trying to do, is to shift that so that we can catch these lung cancers earlier so that we can treat these more effectively.
But the survivability is better right now than it was decades ago, like you mentioned, Prentice, because the treatment has improved. And that's very recent as well. Personalized treatments and better drugs have improved survivability.
Right. Better surgery techniques, better radiation treatment options, more accurate radiation delivery mechanisms.
We have a listener who wanted to know if, I guess they joined late, they wanted to know if marijuana smoke affects the changes of lung cancer, chances of lung cancer, and how much. So I would refer them back to listen to the first part of the show because we did answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're out there, go back and check out the earlier part of the show. But it's not good. It's not good for you. Genetic disposition, vulnerability to lung cancer, is there evidence for that? And should people with a family history of lung cancers be screened, even if they don't have some of these other exposure risk factors?
Family history is considered one of the risk factors in one of the screening criteria guidelines called NCCN, National Comprehensive Cancer Network Screening Guidelines. And family history, if you have a sibling or a parent or a first-degree relative with lung cancer, your relative risk of developing lung cancer yourself is 1.8. All right, so you have about 80% higher risk than another person who does not have a
have a first-degree relative. And there may be families with clusters of cancers, lung cancers, with abnormalities on chromosome 6 and chromosome 15. But this is very early data, so we're not certain about that. And then there are other syndromes where, like Li-Fraumeni syndrome or one of the other mutations that is out there, where these patients get all sorts of different types of cancers. Lung cancer is considered one of those that can be seen in those patients. But in general, family history is not a very, very high risk for developing lung cancer.
Okay, so that alone would not be a reason to go and do that. All right. We are kind of coming down towards the end of the program already, so I'd like maybe for each of you just to take a minute or so and kind of sum up what you would like people to take home from this show, or take home about lung cancer and screening. We didn't get a chance to do much about the treatment, although it is getting better, and early detection is the key. And then there's some cool advances going on that in cancer treatment, lung cancer treatment in particular. So we'll start with you, Marge.
Okay. So every 5 minutes, a woman in the U.S. learns she has lung cancer. And while the lung cancer death rate among men has fallen in the last 35 years, it's increased 116% among women. And nobody seems to know how to stop that trend. So that's why we've created Lung Force, which you can find at lungforce.org, a campaign to bring attention to lung cancer and the fact that anyone can get lung cancer and that it is the number one cancer killer of men and women today. And in fact, it kills more, almost twice as many women as any other cancer.
Wow, that's significant. Dr. Chung?
Yeah, I'd like to add that screening for lung cancer is no substitute for quitting. Quitting is the single most important thing that if you're a smoker that you can do for yourself. And not starting smoking is also very important. So if you are a smoker, please quit. If you want to be screened, please talk to your doctor.
If you've smoked for 20 years and you quit smoking, how long does it take you to reduce your risk?
So statistically, on a population level, 15 years after you've quit, your risk of death is almost the same as that of a non-smoker. But that's not a guarantee on an individual level. That's across a population in terms of statistical risk. So that's why the lung cancer screening says that you are a current smoker or have quit within the last 15 years, because your cancer risk will have gone down.
So even if you've smoked for a long time, it's definitely worth doing. Okay, my thanks to today's guest, Dr. Richard Chung and Marge Stoneking. Please remember to check out the variety of links and information we have available on today's topic. Just go to alaskapublic.org and click on the link to today's show. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can join us on Facebook, and you can find that link on our website, alaskapublic.org. As always, please feel free to share your thoughts and comments about today's show with us at our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Well, a new book makes the case that it's not disease, dollars, or doctors standing in the way of safe and affordable health care. The solution, says the author, includes a new health attitude of patients, providers, and payers. On the next Line 1 Your Health Connection, Dr. Woodard and author John R. Patrick discuss his book, Health Attitude, Unraveling and Solving the Complexities of Healthcare. So why not tune into your health and learn more Monday, November 23rd at 2 p.m., repeating at 8 p.m. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Dave Walgen is our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. Thanks for joining me today on Line 1. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.